sometimes I feel this world is waking to a morning that nobody's ever seen. There's a silence and a golden light is breaking, where storms and darkness yesterday had been. Black man steps out into the sunlight. He is old, but all his dreams are young. He is brave and he is walking into danger in South Africa with new songs to be sung. There's a beauty that brings tears into my eyes when I see a line of hills against the sky. Hear the sound of happy voices in a dusty road. People singing in a snow. If this is reaping, then its faith was sowed long ago, far away, everywhere. Maybe this time the magic will be worth. Maybe this time the seed will catch and grow. Maybe this time the seed will catch and wither. But other seeds lie waiting deep below. There's a beauty that brings tears into my eyes when I see a line of hills against the sky. Hear the sound of happy voices, hear the dusty road, people singing in a snow-cold square. If this is reaping, then its faith was sown long ago, far away, everywhere. Long ago, far away, everywhere.
The spirit of embodiment. We can live as if spirituality is much more than finding the escape route of a planet of suffering, as James O'Dea has put it. Perhaps it is rather about being here and now, in these wonderfully complex bodies and minds, in this magnificent and gorgeous world, and to accept the full potential of a humanity immersed within our vast and diverse circle of sentient beings. Could our opportunity to increase our connectedness with each other on this planet be a step beyond a solitary journey back home?
Thank you, Braden, for that wonderful rendition of possibly my most favorite music of all. And thanks so much to Farrell and Penny for that wonderful piece of music that you offered, you authored, Farrell, at the beginning. That was just great. This next item is the... My name is Doug, by the way, not Dr. Doug. Doug. And that 30 years business was just to let you know what I had to overcome. This talk today about a recovering intellectual, myself, has arisen because one of our members, after the last talk I gave and having heard me say I'm a recovering intellectual for I don't know how many times, said, "Would you please explain what you mean by that?" And so, Jane, here I am. And I enjoy your laugh. This has turned out to be the most difficult of the talks that I have prepared for this church, not just because I've had to deal with jet lag from some very awfully long flights around the planet, but because in actually answering Jane's question or request, I found that I had to open up to some things that I had been kind of glossing over a bit. And as they opened up to me, I wasn't quite sure what to do with them. So as I was preparing this talk, I have to admit there were times I had to escape and watch a hockey game rather than come to grips with what was going on. So I'm at a little loss to know what to say because it's so personal for me. It cuts close to my bone. It cuts close to the wellspring of my being. I love my intellect, and I love my ability to be a critical thinker, and I love to detect patterns in life with which I can build interesting concepts. Conceptual castles in the air, as I call it. So this talk is not really about putting down intellects, in case the title's already challenged a few. I love words, and especially words that make very useful, if nuanced, distinctions. Distinctions that help me live my life more fully. However, I will point out also what I feel are the limitations to words and to language. Limitations which can avoid and cover up important things all around us and within us. So, I'll just define some of these things as what I mean by them. They may not be your definitions, but they're what I'm intending to talk about. For me, an intellect is one who creates, builds, and uses concepts in order to make sense out of the world and makes distinctions that they think are important with these concepts in order to make the world a better place. For me, an addict is one who repeats a behavior over and over again in a vicious cycle, even though the behavior is detrimental to the quality of their own lives and to others. An intellectual addict, then, is, for me, is someone whose conscious attention is largely and almost incessantly on the intellectual process, despite having feedback from others that they need more direct relationships in their lives and in the world. This may ring familiar to some couples. However, such addicts like me can remain relatively oblivious to the needs of family, friends, and others because our conceptual frameworks are being given so much more priority and tend to become separate worlds. Also, intellectual addicts tend to not notice that there is a whole wide, interesting, imaginative, and mysterious world outside of what can be said in the box of language. Fascinating individual meanings and experiences outside of the syntactically rational and logically correct box are prevented from entering into and upsetting the intellectually addictive world. The common box that I have found myself in sits squarely as the space, time, and statistical box of objective science. It is especially challenging for me when I am not even able to imagine that there is something outside of such a box. Normally, what I believe is who I am and what I am naturally comes out of the box of implicitly knowing, not questioning, and with which I am familiar and comfortable. Now, I cannot speak for how others get themselves into intellectual addiction, if that's the case. I'm not even sure how I did, but I think I can point out some events and reasons that contributed to the process. As a child in an extended family of adults occupying a county jail in Picton, Ontario, I was given the attention of a lot of adults and older teenagers who were my caregivers. And they, of course, they often encouraged me to say things and to give answers to questions and all sorts of encouragement to be intellectual, if you like. But the most signal event that happened for me that I think cast myself towards this addiction was what happened to me in kindergarten. In kindergarten, I made the mistake of helping someone else do something when I should have known to let them do it themselves. And the kindergarten teacher wanted me to get the point. And so she took me into the corner, sat me on a stool, and put a dunce cap on my head. Now, you know, it seems kind of funny, and I used to tell it as a funny story, but I don't tell it quite the same way anymore because I realized how angry I was at what she did. And how strongly I resolved to show her and others that no one was ever going to call me a dummy again. No one was ever going to point out my incompetence again. And I resolved it so hard, you know, and as a child we think in black and white terms so much. I just resolved it so strong and so fiercely, it has carried me through a number of decades of my life. Malheureusement. I also listened to what some teachers whispered about me and took on what they were saying secretly. I noticed that silent reading, when I discovered how to do silent reading, that this became an escape from facing parents in everyday life by letting me create a silent and subjective world that I thought I would not have to share. So what is wrong with words, language, and silent reading? Are they not universally positive forces for good in this world? Yes, they are. A lot of good has come from our use of language. But this does not have to blind us to what language has left behind and what we may have lost. In the book Becoming Animal by David Abram, which is our current selection in the Learning Circle, David says, "The printed words that you read circumscribe a symbolic space of communication that we carry on solely among ourselves. A hyper-reflective style of thinking, far too abstract to register the body intelligence of other animals. Often so detached that it renders us, while we're reading, oddly impervious to the promptings of our own animal flesh. The powerful self-enclosed spell." And this is a man who is a magician as well, so he knows about creating spells. "The self-enclosed spell of the written letters easily eclipse a subtler magic, the nuanced exchange between the human animal and the animate earth and all that lives on it." Stephen Jenkinson, a philosopher in Ontario an active philosopher, has indicated that when words are put into a dictionary, their meanings go there to fossilize and die. These meanings move from our personal experience to the compartments, categories, and boxes that keep them nicely ordered and controlled. They become, in a word, I hope this isn't too long, institutionalized. And that's when personal meaning begins to wither. Studies of indigenous language have shown us how they embed systems of meaning and worldviews very different than our own Anglo-Saxon. And I recall here the time when I was in my early 20s, first reading an essay by Benjamin Lee Whorf on the worldview of the Hopi Indians and how he constructed that so beautifully and contrasted it to our own in a way that I saw this makes perfect sense to other people who live this. And it's not the same as mine. That really was a big opening for me. So they work for those who live in them, even though they do not produce our cathedrals of technology and the prison cages of our global economies. In fact, they expose the institutionalization of meaning and the colonization of indigenous minds through massive and overwhelming force of Western meaning, exposing the force of mass culture to colonize and institutionalize our experience of the world. Even science can do this. Its analytic and objective methods have ripped fault lines through the fabric of the wholeness in which we live. But what I find most important to notice is that they standardize and influence the meanings we as unique individuals use to live in the world, forcing our lives, our lived experience, to be perceived only through the lenses of recognized conventions. These compartments can affect the meanings that can easily be shared within families, making intimacy more difficult and challenging. And even as science promotes randomness in statistics that minimizes the richness of our own personal experiences and minimizes the diversity that makes us whole. It is incredibly hard to think outside of these kind of boxes. It's hard to retain the value of our own lives. And for me, I've come to the conclusion, even though this is so hard to do, that every life that is lived is equally important to the entire universe. And so, my outline says that I should then start talking about how one can recover from such an addiction. Well, first it comes by kind of just throwing that away. In a Joanna Macy workshop some years ago, I was doing a similar report as this when I discovered that my heart was directing all of my actions all along, not my intellect, not the logic of the intellectual evidence that I had supposed. It was always my heart that was directing it. At a Sufi retreat in the Rocky Mountains, a voice suddenly but softly filled my space that in my heart of hearts, there was only one heart. It was what was always whispering silently in my ear. Only one human heart for all humans, moving my human heart into action. And now that leads me to shift, to transition from acting and speaking from my intellect to speaking more from my heart. And this is the part that's difficult for me, because I've hidden in the ideas that I'll mention to you now, I've hidden my heart so well. When I was younger, synchronicity was my spiritual path. Not the popular LP by Sting, but the meaning of synchronicity, as Carl Jung put it. That is, unpacking and following coincidences that had strong personal meaning for me. Coincidences that appeared to connect minds and the physical universe beyond space and time. It seemed even that the universe knew my name. So how could I possibly ignore evidence that the universe was more like a hologram than the space-time box of conventional physics? How could I keep ignoring that, even though the evidence occurred for me? When I was young as well, I repeated and carried out experiments that showed me that plants were sensitive to human thought, and that the human mind could be directly connected to another human mind far away. Now, this might stretch your imagination, but I proved that for myself. So how could I go on in my life and ignore that evidence that ourselves and living beings appeared to share a meeting place in our consciousness? A couple of decades after those experiments I did, physics started to do experiments of its own that showed that unquestionably that there are instantaneous connections between particles far away in space and in time. So how is it that we can resist? How can our science and our thinking continue to ignore what this means for how our universe is structured, how it works, how we're really connected? More than a decade ago, when I undertook those workshops with Joanna Macy about reconnecting to nature, especially with the despair work that she did. I don't know about you, but often if I take what's going on in the world seriously, I'm filled with despair, the doom and gloom. And people say, oh God, that's too uncomfortable. We can't go there. I don't want you to go there. Don't talk to me about it. On and on. But in these workshops, I found if we let it really be there, if we really let ourselves occupy it, that underneath that, underneath this terrible despair shared with others, I discovered an enormous love of life and deep currents of joy, the joy of simply being and existing on this planet. That was just overwhelming to me. I might have had a small thought about it here and there, but to actually feel it with my entire being was a revelation. Becoming a social activist in the late 90s, I uncovered a deep river of rage, and a rage against the machine, as the popular music group is called. But underneath this abhorrence of tyranny and my disappointment in a world dominated by elite puppeteers that selfishly manipulate our lives and economies, I found within that an enormous love of democracy, an enormous love of fair play, enormous love of a world without slavery and discrimination of any kind. I found it with all of my being, not just with my logic. I practiced and studied a number of spiritual pathways that promised me a way to the source of creation, to universal oneness, or to a way to get off the wheel of reincarnation. But I discovered, quite recently, that really I was not born on this planet in order to find the first ticket, the first pathway to return to some spiritual home. But I was here rather to progress my connections with others, to fill my life more and more with the love of others. Some 35 years ago, I began attending a very intense workshop of essential inquiry that did not promote a belief system, that nurtured the participants to find answers for themselves about the big and meaningful questions of life, such as who and what we really are. It helped me to see some things. That underneath the social and media persuasion all around me were the deceptions, the snow jobs, and the con game that we could consume and buy our way to happiness. And that by simply consuming the market's products and services, we could achieve our dreams, find pleasure, and endless rewards. That underneath the overwhelming media, political, and even scientific conditioning were messages that we are simply social cogs in a merely random social, economic, and evolutionary process, mere data in vast statistical populations, and that our individual lives lacked any real meaning for the world unless the media or some money found us special. And I also saw that these intensive workshops helped me to appreciate the magnificence of small acts of everyday kindness and love, to understand that true power and fulfillment in this world was generated from within one's own self, that every life lived was filled with significance for others, and that most people wish to share that which is most deeply meaningful for them with others. They show me that deep contact with others, that conscious, unmediated, and instantaneous presence with another could open up the vast presence of a parallel world that interleaved with mine, with bliss as an intrinsic basis. And how is it that we can dare to believe that human beings are masters of evolution, are the pinnacle of evolution, pinnacle of the universe, when humans like us still judge others and other creatures that they are of less value, less economic good, and they are less in God's eyes because they believe in something else, or they appear alien, or they are a different species sharing our planet? I particularly become open to elephants and the sentience of elephants through this book, The Elephant Whisperer, in recent times. I discovered some time ago, working with the hologram metaphor, that there was a little bit of everything everywhere. And when I thought about how this applied to me and to my human beingness, does it not mean that there is a little bit of what we truly are everywhere and everywhen? Perhaps our embodiment as humans is interwoven with bits and pieces of the love between each of us, like the jigsaw puzzle the puppy has scattered all over the floor at Christmas time. And perhaps our journey here on earth is to put all of the fragmented love connections, to do what all of the king's horses and all the king's men could not do, and put Humpty Dumpty together again. There are so many interpretations of spiritual insight and religious belief that have put down the everyday kindnesses and happenings in our world as being transient illusions. Perhaps each act of kindness and love ripples across the cosmos, putting another little piece of Humpty Dumpty together again in uncountable places. In Buddhism, the Bodhisattva vow is when, upon reaching enlightenment, instead of transcending our life on this planet, one vows to return again and again, incarnating to support all sentient beings to achieve the same enlightenment. Well, I actually believe the vow, but not as it's spoken and is normally interpreted. And I would ask you, are we not all bodhisattvas for each other? And are we not already, each of us, actually doing this as spiritual beings acting through our humanness? A long time ago, when I was asked by my academic supervisor, which just happened to be on my first flight on an aeroplane, which I was really scared of, what did I really believe in? I said, everything is connected. Back then, there would be very few people that would have any idea of what I meant. But I am very pleased to say that some 45 years later, a majority of people around me would perhaps agree with this sentiment. And I suspect that this, in the grand scheme of things, is really meaningful overall. So what if being born as humans on this planet is a great opportunity, a powerful gift with which to increase our connectivity with each other, and hence increase the overall connectivity in the cosmos? Recently, astronomers and physicists have become enamored about the possibility that we may exist not in a universe, a single universe, but in a multiverse, a kind of blend of many universes coexisting in parallel, though there are many different interpretations of this idea. But what if this multiverse consisted of all the possible worlds that any human or any creature or any alien intelligence could ever imagine? What if all these possible worlds coexisted and were superimposed, interlayered in parallel with our physical world and all of the other worlds in this cosmos? Would this not be reflected in the ways that the vast community of cells, the communities of molecules and energy systems, and even all of the friendly microbes in our body are organized? We are living in a multiverse as human beings. What of all the things our parents, our dear friends, and our intellectuals and our society tell us that we are or are not, are just distractions and obstacles, and that underneath the well-meaning busybodies telling or implying all of these things to us about who and what we truly are, what if underneath all of that, all of those distractions, we are beautiful, boundless beings, children playing on the seashores of endless worlds? Well, that's quite an agenda that my heart has laid out. And my human response to it includes fear and trepidation. I recall just recently seeing the statue of Giordano Bruno, the centerpiece of a market called Campo di Fiore in Rome, commemorating the spot where he was burned at the stake in 1600, in part for promoting the claim that the universe contained an infinite number of inhabited worlds populated by other intelligent beings. A couple of generations ago, that was not even considered by scientists, and now it's all the rage. But he was burned at the stake, and hence my fear of stepping on people's cherished beliefs, my fear of appearing too grandiose to others, my fear of being misunderstood, but especially my fear that in my life I will only move a tiny sliver towards all of these musings of my heart. And so, I will typically retreat behind the shield and protection of my intellect, writing and speaking with a few friends about these things from time to time, as if this could really actually substitute for strong and courageous worldly action that could follow them up. For you see, this recovering intellectual here is really a cover-up. It's a work in progress, a work very much in progress for recovering my human heart and letting it shine in the light of day. And I wish to say that my recent work has led me to strongly believe that we humans in these bodies have the potential, with our hearts open, to transcend the shortcomings of our over-consuming and addictive civilization, especially if we direct our thoughts and our actions with others towards their hearts in our awareness. And may the courage and integrity of Nelson Mandela inspire us in such ventures. Thank you. And for closing words, I'm keeping the words of a woman called Anna Breitenbach, who in a recent film is called The Animal Communicator, in mind. She lives in South Africa as well. And she says, we are living in a world borrowed from our children's future. And this movie has impressed me no end. It's been the most important thing I've seen in a decade or more. So for closing words, as much as I can, I hold the intention to live in the blessing of consciousness, the blessing of a self-awareness that more and more includes how my personal embodiment is a reflection of the entire world. I set out to live as if each relationship in which I engage with another is an opportunity to expand the breadth of each other's awareness. And as I increase my ability to include the uniqueness and equal value of another's existence, I imagine how these relationships could be rippling across the entire cosmos, as perhaps they truly are. Thank you.